Welcome to the Minimum Viable Podcast, a project of the Defense Entrepreneurs Forum. Our mission is to inspire, connect, and empower people in order to promote a culture of innovation in the U.S. national security community. You can learn more about DEF and get involved at DEF.org. That's DEF.org. We look forward to your ideas and are excited to connect you with other doers working on hard problems.
I met Corey, 2018, Corey?
Yeah, it's been a couple of years, huh?
Yeah, man. So at the time, I was the associate director of Pivotal Labs' Washington, D.C. office. And right around the time that Kessel Run was spinning up in the D.C. office, the 480th ISR wing also showed up and brought a team of folks. And one of those people was Corey Bowman. Corey, at the time you were, thinking, what were you, like an E4?
Yeah, I had just put on staff like, 2 months before. So E5, but brand new, you know?
Yeah. Like literally like came in backpack on both shoulders, you know, like ready to learn, and then ran this engagement for 6 months as the product manager of this team, that built a tool, called Narwhal. And then Narwhal went back to Langley Air Force Base and kind of lived in a closet for how long, Corey?
I think we kept it alive maybe 4 or 5 months afterwards, and it just kind of fizzled.
All right, so then it fizzled. And then, Corey, you are the Air Force's first ever product manager.
Yeah, right. There's a technicality there. I don't want to take any cloud away from any other airman who's been a product manager. But as far as the AFSC goes, right? So like, I don't have to worry about doing another job. This is what y'all are paying me to do. I'm on the front lines there.
Okay. And then you leave the closet down at Langley Air Force Base and head up to Boston, where you have now been the product manager on 2 Kessel Run teams. That is a hell of a story. That is a hell of a journey. Part of the reason why I'm so stoked to hear from you is because I feel like that is a story that a lot of fellow soldiers, airmen, sailors are either experiencing now. It's a journey they might want to be on, and the place where you wound up is like exactly where you ought to be in your mm-hmm. career. And that's like a whole reason why I've been passionate about getting involved in this federal space over the last few years. Like it's this kind of thing, man. So that's awesome. I'm really stoked you're here. So I wonder if on that kind of arc there of going from being an E4, probably getting yelled at, to working on Narwhal as a product manager, to then taking Narwhal back and not getting any respect, to then becoming the first career product manager to working at Kessel Run. What was that story like? Can you walk us through?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit of background, right? I my original job that I came into the Air Force as has nothing to do with product management. So, you know, have that in mind. I came in as a linguist. And then when I was leaving basic training, they said, okay, here's a piece of paper that we're going to throw away anyways, but you know, write down whatever language you want. I said, okay, well, I just scratched on there. Whatever's the difficult one, give me that. I may as well make use of this time here. So they made me an Urdu linguist. And if you don't know what that is, you're in the majority. It's what's spoken in Pakistan. And as of, I don't know, like 3 years ago, the Air Force said, hey, we don't care either. So let's stop. I'll stop making you guys, and we'll stop posting missions for it. And this is nothing new, right? It comes and goes, and global conflicts change. But I was getting to my first duty station as an Urdu linguist, where we were 250% stocked, and there was no mission for us. And looking around, like, all right, what can I do? Because it's clearly not language. I spent about 9 months on night shift, and I thought that was pretty miserable. Let's not do that again. And one of the biggest pains I had was like the software just kind of sucked, right? Like it didn't work right. I couldn't make decisions off of it. And, you know, there was this kind of constant turmoil in the unit of like things kind of suck. The mission doesn't really feel like it's worth it. I don't know what I'm doing. But we couldn't quite make those claims without data, right? And so the first of many times of being in the right place at the right time, there was this, you know, duct taped together database of, you know, hey, one of our many missions, let's collect the data and see if we can't actually make legitimate claims about it's not actually doing anything. Because night shift was miserable, I taught myself a little bit of coding, thinking maybe I could escape the black hole that was night shift at the NSA. Turns out I'm not any good at it, but it was enough to get me off of the night shift floor and into the back shop where we could turn one little tiny database that was collecting like three pieces of data per night into this huge apparatus of the unit that was collecting hundreds of pieces of data every mission to help us validate when we said, look, this mission isn't working, it's not doing anything. We can actually put numbers to that. So we can say, look, we're spending seven hours of four airmen's lives to get zero intel value. Maybe we can reevaluate that. And that claim went a whole lot further than like, oh, you know, my airmen are complaining. And so that was kind of act one, right? How do I get out of being a linguist? From there, again, I happened to be in the right place at the right time. The 480th was looking at how do we make DCGS more effective? And maybe the rumor mill had, you know, dusted up this database that I was working on, and people heard about that and wanted it a little bit. And it was just kind of, you know, luck of the draw that the application process had come around. I applied for it and got picked up to build this other DCGS application, right? How do we schedule folks on missions knowing that they're not super effective? How do we make them more effective with our schedules? So I show up to Pivotal thinking, okay, I'm going to go build some software. Not too great at it, but I'm hoping to learn. And like day one, they're like, hey, you're going to be a product manager. Like, all right, I don't know what that means. It doesn't sound like software, and I'm not super excited about it. 3 days later, I was so glad that that was the reality, because product management, I like fell in love with it. And that was like what I was, you know, supposed to be doing there. And so we spent 6 months learning a lot, right? A lot about lean, agile, key terms and things like that. I realized a lot of it was processes that we were already trying to do, just kind of putting key terms to it. You know how TDYs work at day 179, you either got to like cough up way more money for a whole different, you know, payment system, or you got to start over on a new TDY. We opted to head back home, take this project Narwhal with us. That was a whole basket of headaches. You're right. The project did end up in a little closet on Langley, and I ended up working out of my spare bedroom at home. And that was like wild, right? Being a young airman and then just not going into work and being responsible for this team that was, you know, two states away. And yeah, that was all weird. And eventually it kind of crashed and burned, and I was looking for something else to do. Another right place, right time, ended up in a meeting where the wing commander of the 70th had charged a couple of folks to say, how can we be more innovative? How can we start to solve problems rather than just waving money wands at things? And so I met a lot of really interesting folks. Actually, my airman now, David Ahn, I met him there in that meeting. Sean, I don't remember if you were there, but you showed up probably the very next day. I worked at this thing called the Innovation Center, which, you know, is super buzzwordy. But we actually did a lot of things by not innovating projects and more about teaching airmen. From there, got a call from or a text from my old parents said, hey, you know, Kessel Run's looking for PMs that like really want to be a PM. You know, you might think about digging in there. So, you know, made some inquiry and everything lined up, and they were able to use the 8-kilo mechanic AFSC to get me to come to Kessel Run. So as a 1 in 3, an Urdu linguist, they were able to actually switch me out, bring me there. So I don't have to worry about the language. I don't have to worry about this other job. And I can focus on being a PM, and it has been fantastic. A year in now, I'm like finally hitting stride where I feel comfortable enough doing my job that I can start to kind of give back to the community, right? Like, what lessons have I learned? Can I write those things down and share them back out? Can I participate in conversations like this? So that's where I'm at now. Kind of in the beginning stages of facing these larger questions of what does it mean to be a PM as an airman? What does it mean to be a PM as a 7 skill level, as an NCO? If you were an officer, right, how would that thing be different? What are the expectations? How can we solidify the lessons we learn now, so that way when you start to train airmen in this discipline, we actually have two legs to stand on? So I'll pause there at the end of that long retelling of my history.
That's super cool, man. So what I think is really cool about that story is it's like you live all the seasons of a software practitioner. Like you lived the days when like life sucked before you learned software skills. Then you like lived an engagement where all the resources were handed to you and you had 6 months to just like learn. But then it kind of like didn't achieve the kind of adoption and traction that you wanted to achieve. And then you got sent back home and you were living in a closet, kind of like, what am I doing? Probably feeling destitute. And then pop over to, you know, now you're on this like journey, find yourself over in the 70th, do that gig. And now you're at Kessel Run and you've like moved two applications to user adoption. Can you speak a little bit to kind of like those phases of your journey? Like what was it like to like learn what right looks like and then feel like you weren't doing it and then get back into Kessel Run and like really do it in a place where that, where you're able to thrive?
Yeah. Oh man, you're going to bring back some feelings. Like I remember the click moment at Pivotal, right? Like this is the way we should do things. This is how software is meant to be done, right? And I say that with all of the context of three months of experience, right? Like I didn't know a whole lot, but I knew enough to know that that was a whole lot better than what we were doing. And then I remember kind of the exact opposite, getting back to the 70th and realizing like, oh, this is not how we should be doing things, right? Like not having commercial internet.
I was going to say, Corey, could you like really dig into that a little bit more? Yeah. Just like, be precise, because Jay, who's not able to talk at the moment, we are actively working through this, like trying to like software development has its own core skill set, but like product management, that is like a very nebulous concept for a lot of people in this space. It's almost like an afterthought. You know, we know that we need doctors, but nobody thinks that we need like hospital administrators. So like, I'd really love to hear you like just scratch on that a little bit more.
Sure, absolutely. So talking specifically right at Pivotal, the high moment was like, great, I have the tools I need. I have the access that when I don't understand a concept, I can go do research on it. I can go talk to other professionals. What does it mean when my velocity goes all wonky? What does it mean when I have a high volatility? How can I help bring those things in? What happens when I have a disagreement on a technical implication? How do I drive this business value? All of that was available to me with practitioners who had made those mistakes or learned on their own, and I could help to grow from that. Contrast with getting back to being on an island by myself with people who didn't understand that product management was even a concept. It was a constant fight of like, yes, I'm only an E5, but I am actually capable of being responsible for others, right? I am actually capable of being responsible for a lieutenant on the team. I am responsible of, you know, driving a business value, even explaining the concept of a business value, of trying, of learning, of experimenting. All of those things were like pulling teeth, because not that people hated the ideas, right? But it's just not the way we've done things. And so that was the kind of pure contrast, is that with everything available and such open mind about learning and trying and experimenting, and then getting back to this world where it was just not accepted to do those things, or we just didn't know about them, right? Like it wasn't even part of the lexicon to say, I'm going to try this thing and I expect to see this result. People look at you like deer in the headlights, right? And so feeling that was what brought me to like, this is not the way to do things. Dropping airmen back into a culture where they're outnumbered and no one speaks their language. Pivotal TDYers back into a culture where they're outnumbered, no one speaks their language, they don't have the infrastructure, commercial internet is out of the question, tools are out of the question, experts are out of the question. It felt really impossible to do anything except for just to try and not turn back into the kind of naysayer airmen that a lot of us, you know, are before we realize this world is out there.
With that in mind, like, so that, all right, so you lived like the days where you're banging rocks together. You lived the days where you get all the resources you need. Mm-hmm. You lived the days where those resources were kind of like not given to you. And now you're living the days where like you are in an organization that that does this. Like, what does it feel like today to be inside a mm-hmm. inside a Kessel Run among a bunch of product managers and teams?
It's a really good question, because I think this is, for me, right, I like to create things. I like to be at the starting edge. This for me is like we're just planting the seeds. This is like the first harvest, right? So it's a good mix in between leaving that culture where we don't know these terms and we don't do these practices, but it's not a fully fledged, been here for 10 years, have all of the industry experts, right? We're still all learning a lot. And so I'm really enjoying the opportunity to take the experience I've had over the last couple of years and mentor younger PMs, PMs that are coming in and they've only got 6 months experience, or PMs that it sucks, right? But they're like a software developer and they're doing this as 6 months TDY, or they're an acquisition person and I can kind of relate to them and help them avoid the pitfalls I had. But on the other end too, like we do have some experts, right? A mentor of mine, Rob McDonald, he's our practice lead for PM. He's like 30 years experience, right? Like dude has been around. And so it's a good mix of trying to take that one guy who knows all this stuff. I'm right in the middle. And then there's a lot of people who maybe haven't tried all the tools. How can I help to bridge that gap, right? Get what's in his mind and Rob's mind, the expertise, and try and get it into tangible documents, into artifacts, into learnings that the younger PMs can go and benefit the same way I benefited from a place like Pivotal. So I think we're in the like rapid growth stage, right? There's so many PMs that a lot of us are junior. And then it's on us as the seniors or the ones who, you know, just kind of have been around longer, made those mistakes to make sure that we're paying back into the system and getting our own kind of Kessel Run flavor documentation, our own what does it mean to be a PM as an airman kind of document and artifacts.
Yeah, I wonder if you could speak maybe at a high level. I'm not sure how much you're comfortable sharing about the projects that you have been the PM on. Maybe just like going back to the first one that you did with the 480th. But I'm especially curious about the what you're doing at Kessel Run, because that's like big leagues, you know.
Yeah, you want to know like what, like generally what the project was?
Yeah,
sure. Okay, so elevator pitch time, right? Yeah. Project Narwhal is better than unicorns because narwhals actually exist. So there was an old software called, what was it called? It was called Unicorn, and it was like supposed to do some stuff for DCGS, the Distributed Common Ground System, intel gathering, right? But it didn't do all the things it promised. And so we started this application called Narwhal to kind of squeeze that thing out, right? Push it out of the way and actually deliver some value. You know, we made some mistakes. There was a little bit of maybe underestimating of the cost and the political value, but all in all, it was meant to help DCGS units schedule their folks better, right? Save more time, not waste schedules, not have to reschedule, things like that. Fast forward, I worked on an application called Spacer. So for the Air Operations Center, if you're going to fly planes, you got to fly planes in airspace so they don't crash. Somebody's got to manage that airspace, and that's what Spacer does. And now I'm on a team called Gambit, and you know, just like airspace, you got to not only request airspace, but you got to request air support to go in that airspace. And so instead of using sticks and stones and Excel sheets, Gambit allows anyone to request air support of the AOC. So that's what we're focused on right now.
Super cool, man. I want to ask you a million questions at the same time. I'm not sure which one to ask you first. I'm going to choose a direction. Your rank now, you're what, an E6?
Yep. I just put on Tech Sergeant a couple weeks ago.
Okay. So my experience, I mean, I'm just a dude from Berkeley, California that wound up landing in this environment, and it's been awesome. So, you know, what do I know about ranks and all that? But what I've observed is that leaders tend to gravitate toward treating the product manager position as a leadership position that warrants putting an officer into. Mm-hmm. In many cases, it's like we need to put a major into that role because they're in charge of the team and everybody needs to look up to that major. And here you are, having been on a journey of leading some pretty impactful teams. And the other question I was going to ask you, which I'll just kind of like foreshadow to, is that Spacer and Gambit are, they're not just like piddly apps that are over here, like, you know, like, hey, you know, Sergeant Bowman, keep yourself busy, like try not to break anything. Like these are like parts of a system mm-hmm. that are like, you know, C2 for the Air Force. So, you know, this is no BS. So what was it like for you to be an enlisted airman as a product manager of like serious software teams that are in production fighting the war?
Yeah, that's a good question. I will say right up front, I think this is a thing that I think about a lot, and that doesn't mean it's negative or positive, but it's I always wonder, right, like, is there a better way to do things, or you know, is my rank affecting it? But it definitely comes up in my thought process. And so I'll start back at the beginning, right? Not only had I just put on staff, I'm also fairly young, right? Tech sergeant at 8 years is young. And also I came in at 19, right? So I'm like generally young for the people I'm working around, which kind of puts me at a little bit of a disadvantage in two ways, right? I remember there were a couple times back on Narwhal where Jason, he was a lieutenant. I think he was a tech sergeant turned lieutenant, right? So definitely a mentor. But a lot of the communication like went through him instead of me because he was a lieutenant and I was a product manager. And I was like, what, how can I do my job, right? Like if you put me in this position as a PM, but the information is flowing around me, how can I A, do my job? And then how can my developer do his job, right? If he's the lieutenant, but you're distracting him with PM stuff. And so there was definitely a couple of days where I was like, you know what? NCOs aren't cut out to do this. You just need to put a major in there because the Air Force is not ready to talk to staff sergeants like adults. Obviously that was a short-sighted, you know, kind of upset staff sergeant opinion to have. And I've since grown out of it. But I think there was a little bit of truth to it, right? Is that the larger organization has to accept the PM as capable for it to work at all. I think a shorthand for us accepting people as capable is rank, but that doesn't always pan out, right? We can look at someone who's a major or a senior master sergeant and say, hey, they're probably capable, right? They're probably capable of leading folks. But is that always true? Maybe not. And vice versa, right? You can look at a senior airman or a second lieutenant and say, they haven't really proven their salt when it comes to leadership or capability. But is that always true? No, not really, right? Like the measure of someone's capability to lead is probably their capability to lead, not just their rank. And so that took me a while to learn, right? Is that it wasn't about me getting more stripes or commissioning. It was about kind of proving to the larger community that folks who could lead regardless of rank. There was also a conversation I remember Sean and I had when we would do these facilitations and sometimes it would be large groups of E3s and E4s. And sometimes it'd be like O5s, O6s, or sorry, yeah, O4s, O5s. And we would have E7s, E8s in the room. And we would sit and talk like, should we wear uniforms or should we not, right? What are they going to think if a staff sergeant walks in there and starts telling them this and that about innovation and facilitation? And I think we wore our uniforms, right? Because we decided that it was more important for them to see a capable staff sergeant and a capable master sergeant than it was for them to know that we were capable and guess about our ranks, right? Like we really wanted to prove that point that it is not only the rank that determines how capable you are. All that being said, I think there's a lot you learn that comes with going through the ranks, right? Like to put on staff, you have to go through Airman Leadership School. Like a lot of the principles that I use about communication and leadership and conflict resolution and time management, all that is reinforced by those classes. Doesn't mean it's the only way to get it, but it's definitely, I feel more equipped to be a product manager having gone through those. And I imagine it's the same way for someone who's a major, right? Like probably your background better equips you than somebody who are going to pick up off the street. My question has always been, why can't we make that level of learning or education or ability available to anyone who wants to be a product manager, not just product managers who have been majors, right? Or product managers who have been NCOs before. So that's kind of the answer to the first question, right? It's been a positive and it's been a negative. I think overall, I have been challenged by, you know, not being a major, but it's always come through as a opportunity for success to change another mind. And then if you could rephrase your second question, I think I've lost it by now.
Yeah, no, that's cool, man. I actually want to like I'll put a pin in that second question for a second and like just drill in a little bit further into this thing about being a staff sergeant. Like in that trough between working on a Pivotal Labs engagement in DC to going up to Kessel Run, you now have been enlightened thinking in these kind of new ways. What challenges did you face there in that kind of in that middle ground, trying to like spread these new methods of thinking and problem solving in your community?
That's a good one. So I learned that I had just enough knowledge to be dangerous, and that rank does matter in a lot of situations, right? So you say I had been enlightened, and I kind of saw the light. Yes, but I don't think I understood it. I certainly didn't have, with my 6 months experience, enough to really be telling people the things that I probably told them, right? And that was, it was a learning experience, right? If I'm going to make claims, I should be able to back it up. I knew just enough about lean and agile to understand that waterfall, probably not the best way, right? Like being a hippo, probably not the best way, but to like claim expertise and say, this is the way to do it. I certainly should not have been making those claims, you know, with the little bit of expertise or the little bit of experience I had. But thankfully, I had leadership that pushed back a little bit and was like, look, I get what you're trying to do. Back it up, right? Like, you know, just know what you're saying, right? Have a little bit more ammo when you're making these claims. And then the other thing is rank does exist, right? So that was the second half, is that being a staff sergeant and just openly questioning a major about like, well, why do you think that, right? What's your proof? What's your acceptance criteria? What's the experiment you're learning? Like that does not fly. And that's a good thing, right? Like we don't want just open insurrection of people questioning every order, every direction, right? We have this establishment of rank for a reason. And sometimes it is worthwhile to talk about, okay, what could the world be? And sometimes it's also really important that we understand that those constructs exist for a reason and we need to act when we're told to, and we need to kind of respect the rigidity of the structure because that person has been given authority for a reason, right? And so specific examples, we're talking about like, hey, let's try and run this experiment within the unit. You know, I think staff sergeant thinks that if we do this thing, we might see that different result. And a major's like, look, I don't have time to explain to you why, but like, let's not do this right now. Let's not do this week. At that point, I have to understand that a lot of the things that come with being a major is more context, more authority, more understanding, right? Higher responsibility to make sure that the right things happen. And I have to respect that decision because I don't have all the information. I don't have all the expertise that major has. And so, you know, it's not the end all be all, but it definitely shouldn't be thrown away, right? In search of this ideal world.
Jim, you came off mute, man. You got a question?
Yeah, so there's many, many questions I'd want to ask you, but hearing what you're talking about there with like moving to a sort of a bottom-up product development system where and recognizing the difference in expertise at levels, there's perhaps context and broader view of things is higher at higher levels, whereas expertise, and so it's almost, I want to like, I don't want to push back on you, but sort of like highlight that it's sort of a two-way street. Like the people that you're working for above you, like they have to understand that like, in that moment, that major has to say, like, hey, I don't have the time to explain it right now. Like, you're not entirely wrong, but in this moment, we're going to do something else. But also have the sort of the humility to be able to say, I don't know, and I'm going to go to my principal engineers who do know because they're a subject matter expert when it comes to, you know, secure network tunneling. Like, I know broader strategy stuff, and I'm going to rely on you for your expertise. So it goes both ways, and that's actually a good thing.
Yeah. You bring up a good point, right? The I don't know and I want to ask the expert. I'll be the first to admit that was a behavior that changed almost immediately in me going back, right? I was very comfortable at Pivotal saying, I don't know, let's ask the expert, let's ask the dev. Like day one I got back, it was like, hey, staff sergeant, you should know the answer, right? Like, if you're in charge, you should know the answer. What's the deal, right? I saw that in a lot of people. I saw it in squadron leadership, right? Of like, we put you in charge of these things and you should know the answer. You should know how to get the answer. And sometimes that is a legitimate claim, right? Like, you should know what's going on with your folks. But that's, it's like a cultural thing almost that I felt going back of this expectation as a staff sergeant to know everything a staff sergeant should know. And like, not, you shouldn't be caught asking, hey, can I get a refresher on how to do an ACA, right? I want to make sure I'm doing the best job. Can I have somebody walk me through it again? It's like, oh, well, you should know that, right? It's a little bit of weirdness of like, maybe it's not quite acceptable to admit that you're not an expert on something, right? That you should be, or that kind of structurally that rank demands. I've definitely seen a huge, huge improvement, right? And in just the past couple of years of having this culture where it is okay to not know everything or to want to learn or want to increase your ability. But a couple of years ago, going back to Fort Meade, that was like an immediate culture shock. I saw it even in myself of not wanting to admit that I didn't know something or I had to ask someone and feeling like I had to have the answer because of some stripes on my arm.
That makes me want to unpin the thing that I wanted to ask you before. You know, like one of the things that I certainly know one thing, which is I don't know a whole lot. I think that one of the things that like extreme programming is all about is continuous learning. You know, I certainly don't claim to that all pivotal labs engagements all hit the mark every time. And one of the engagements that was in my portfolio was a product called Spacer that you inherited when it went back to KREL. And KREL, or rather Spacer, didn't really have adoption when you inherited it. It was the first of the two projects that you inherited, right? So here's this like incoming, what at the time, E6?
You're coming still staff.
Okay, so you're an E5, you're coming in as an E5, you inherit this product Spacer. It's been built hand in hand with Pivotal Labs, who apparently know everything about how to build software right. It's somewhere, you know, in the fifth inning of the game. Mm-hmm. And here you come as an E5 and you pick up this app and you look at it. And I think you said, this is not actually what it needs to be, right? Like how did you make that call? Mm-hmm. How did you develop the psychological safety to kind of say those words out loud? This app is missing. And then how did you steer your team toward developing as part of that larger ecosystem, as part of that larger portfolio?
Yeah, that's a lot, right? I want to be
asking that question from two perspectives. Yeah. One is as an E5, you're doing that. Mm-hmm. Is like as a product manager of a product that you've inherited that's going in a direction that you need to kind of correct and bring into a system.
Mm-hmm. So I see that Dalton's on, right? I think he was the PM I took over for, and I definitely, this is by no means to slam him or say that he wasn't doing his job. So I want to preface that, right? There's when I took over Spacer, let me back up. I've said things before like, this project missing the mark, right? Or we're not hitting it, or we're succeeding. And then I got made a fool because I didn't have data to back that up. I wasn't making a claim based on evidence. I was making a claim based on my gut or my feeling or how I thought it looked. And so I wanted to be really careful with that when I showed up to Kessel Run to not make that mistake again. So when I got onto Spacer, the first thing I did was start asking questions because that's not what I've done in the past and it's bit me. So I started asking questions, right? I didn't know anything about Spacer. I certainly didn't have an opinion. But when I started asking questions, things began to get fishy the longer I asked the question. So I was there for maybe a month and a half and everything seemed fine. And then I asked one of the devs, like, why do you think we don't have user adoption? And he was like, what? We do have user adoption. It's been like that for a long time. Like, okay, well, I have now two conflicting evidence pieces, right? Like the devs know we have user adoption, but when I called yesterday, the guy who was supposed to be using it had no clue what the app even was, right? So this wasn't like even on the team, like somewhere else the problem had come up, right? Were we not communicating earlier? And we started asking more questions and asking more questions. And then I kind of raised the idea of like, not, oh, Spacer's ugly or, oh, we missed the mark. Is like, hey, I think something's going on here and it's worth investigating more, right? And that was kind of the first step is being able to say something's not adding up. And then to be able to back that up with, okay, here's the evidence that's not adding up, right? We're saying 2 and 2 is 5. Let's, as a team, try and find the answer without blaming folks or poo-pooing an effort. Following that, we did a lot of data gathering of, let's start asking questions to the users. Let's actually figure out who's using this. Let's figure out what's the roadmap. What do the stakeholders expect of this? And it was a lot of like, I don't know, you guys are the product team, right? And so we were able to kind of pinpoint this initial breakdown of the product team was going in a direction and the kind of portfolio thought it was going somewhere else. And through a lot of mishaps, right? Like reality was not matching the mental model that we had built. And so at that point, I felt comfortable to say, look, we can graph out, we can put it on a piece of paper, we can hold this thing up and point to where it's not adding. So that way we're not attacking a person. We're not complaining about a personality or a gut feeling. And we can say, look, we ran an experiment. Here was the results of it. Results are not what we wanted. Let's change the experiment, right? That was a much more fruitful conversation. And it went a whole lot better as opposed to like, I don't like this, or it's missing the mark, or something's not going right here. And so after that had happened, we asked, okay, hey, we ran this experiment of what's going on. The result that came back was we're not doing what's useful for the user. And we asked for time to, you know, kind of do a re-DNF. The answer I got was no, Spacer is not complicated. Just build the effing tool. Why is this taking so long, right? And I had to say, yes, sir. And it was right, because it was like, look, stop fooling around, right? Like the data exists. The research is done. Stop, you know, going off of a gut feeling or one person's expectation and do the job that we're paying you to do. And my opinion was that I needed more research, right? But the feedback I got was, look, you know, in not so many words, like, I need you to use the research you have and make do with what you have, right? Get more research, but I can't give you more time. And that was, it was valuable feedback, right? To understand the earnest in his voice and to hear that, like, this product has to show some result, right? Even if the result is turning it off. Like, let's move forward. We can't take the time off to just do research. So that was another instance of like, again, like rank plays a part. I have to know that this person, you know, not necessarily just by military rank, but by their standing in the organization, has more context than I do and knows how important it is to keep this thing moving and trying rather than taking time off to do research on the side. So that was a little bit of like frustration immediately when I heard it. And then after a couple days of reflection, I was like, oh, okay, I understand, right? This was not tearing down psychological safety or telling me to get in my place. This was sharing with me the context of how important it was that we make a decision and move forward, right? And we stop over planning and over researching, and we start to get a healthy mix of, orient, plan, and execute, and then research off of that so we can do more orienting and planning rather than kind of flip-flopping between the two. So I know that was a little bit of a vague story and kind of broad, but hopefully that sheds a little bit of light on the question.
Doug, it's awesome, man. I could keep asking you questions all afternoon. I want to open the floor up to others who are hanging out here who might have questions. Thank you.
I had a question that I don't know everybody that's on, but do we have representation from industry that can talk to, obviously when you through study of that, that they have rank structure within a civilian organization or a government or non-government organization where they have stakeholders, where they have responsibility for budget, schedule, time, that still is much applicable in industry as well. I'd like to hear those kind of thoughts in relationship to what Corey just talked about, if there's somebody on that can talk to that.
So I do product management very similar to this. And the story that Corey was just talking about, like, I think the term you just need to weave in there is like recognizing that we need to snap the line and find an MVP and then just get that out there and start iterating off of that instead of trying to like build a Corvette before you have a go-kart. It's definitely a problem that, so I guess there's two parts. The rank structure is totally a thing. And the challenge that the military is having is understanding like who has the expertise and who has the expertise and the role of senior leaders in this. In traditional operational units, it's a top down, like here is the goal. You guys have to figure out how to make it happen, as opposed to the bottom up style where leaders' jobs are to figure out how to reallocate resources and figure out how to keep their teams unblocked, you know, where they need to drive escalations and prioritization and fill those needs for them. And it's hearing him talk through this in the military context is actually very, very timely. Like Jay and I talk about this regularly and sort of the challenges of getting people into this very different style of work into a military context. I keep coming back because my wife's a pediatrician. I keep coming back to the concept of how we have an entire medical structure where you can have experts in junior ranks who are still, you know, clinical practitioners who, you know, they have MD, PhD in, you know, neurobiology. And so, yes, they know infinitely more than the 06 who just happens to be a general pediatrician. So you're going to take those cues that way. This is just at a totally different scale where you have people who are, there's no central credential management system. Like Corey can read a bunch of books and be an E6 who's just kicking ass. We don't have a way to say like no amount of ASIs is ever going to really accumulate for the wealth of knowledge and experience you may have acquired somewhere else. And so it's going to be this like long road challenge of building the culture in these organizations, but it definitely seems like the lessons that are coming out of, you know, KR and the other, really primarily the Air Force software factories that have gone through these growing pains, and, you know, folks like Nick or other people who have built these cultural artifacts that really help push forward the idea of what psychological safety, trust, or some of the, like the Amazon leadership principles. I work at Microsoft, spent 2 years there, and those things got drilled into me. Like, have backbone, disagree and commit. Like that is a part of being a good leader at every level. And it's a two-sided thing. Like you are expected to speak up, but when a leader says, sorry, we're not doing that, you are expected to commit and execute. And that's just the nature, because decisions have to be made and we all have to be on board. We can't have some people like sabotaging it. So it's critical piece you're bringing up, Corey. And it's I don't know if anybody has a clear answer for it. But I'm really glad that you were on here today to talk through your experience and being one of the few enlisted people in this space. We truly don't have enough, and we haven't thought through talent management in technology. Getting back to that military or the military medical context, like all of our physicians are officers, come in as an O3. Like we don't even have a paradigm for how to have like highly skilled E4s and E6s. So it's going to be a struggle.
Incredible. What else?
I'll just use a military reference in regards to that same. Okay.
You're so soft-spoken, Brian.
Oh. Yeah, I was going to say there's a really great story from Amazon, actually. Greg Linden had a blog post about it a long time ago. To give you an idea how long ago, it was the shopping cart recommendation engine. That says like other people who bought this item also bought these things. When he implemented that was we weren't in the era where Google listened to you on your phone and made recommendations when you opened up your phone. Like, and so the VP actually told him that was a bad idea and he wouldn't let it go through. And he actually implemented it in ops and collected a bunch of data off of it via A/B testing, and then went back to the VP and showed like a 2% increase, which for Amazon is, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And I think that's a really great example of, you know, this idea of ideas over titles. The idea here, though, is, or the takeaway is that data is your friend. don't get into the argument, just do the thing, collect the data and come back. And I think the story of Kessel Run's really interesting in that regards. Like, we never ever asked anybody if we could do anything. And I think the story that came out of Kessel Run is people hear that Dr. Roper did it or Steve Wirt did it. All these people, well, not Roper per se, but there were a bunch of these people that now say they, you know, made Kessel Run that were actually people that were against Kessel Run. But we got inside of their OODA loop. That's the military reference. So I think the idea here is get a small amount of resources. Don't go pitch and ask for $10 million to do a $10 million thing. Get enough resources to build one single MVP, build it. And most of the decision makers in industry and in the Department of Defense are on quarterly decision cycles. So if you can deploy software inside of a quarter, then you have a data-based conversation instead of a theoretical conversation. It's just like, I deployed this, here was the results. And the results might be bad, and that's okay, but like, there's always gonna be learnings, there's always gonna be things. As much as you can get away from the theoretical boardroom conversations and into the I deployed it and here's what happens conversations, the better off you're gonna be.
If I may share one item too. So my name is Eric Laubacher. I'm on the Pivotal team. And I've over time taken over part of the work that Mikey was doing with Kessel Run. One of the things I've seen now that the organization has matured some too is psychological safety is really pushed hard by the upper level and the upper echelons as well. So I work quite closely with several of them. And I mean, it's one of the things that will constantly come up in our leadership conversations is like, you know, making sure there's psychological safety, deferring to the people with the skills. Corey, I was wondering if you wanted to talk some about that, how that structure works.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first thing that came to my mind was that psychological safety is less about making sure the PM gets heard and more about the PM making sure that the expert gets heard. Too many times I get an IM like, hey, what's the thing on this? Like, I don't just talk to the dev, right? The dev is the expert. The dev, like, if I'm being a good PM, I think that part of that is making sure that the dev has enough context that they can understand where we're going and they can be bought into the mission, right? So when we're talking about, hey, is this thing technical, feasible? What's the timeline on this? Like, do I really have to go set up a meeting with my developer? Can they have the safety to talk with someone they haven't met before, to talk with someone a little bit higher up in the leadership structure and not be wigged out? Like, that to me is more important and a better show of psychological safety than just saying like, oh, well, I'm a PM and I don't get my feelings hurt, right? Like, I feel like I can say radical things in a meeting. Like, of course, right? I'm the kind of person who's gonna say that anyways, and fine, right? I wanna make sure that the expert who doesn't get to be in the conversation all the time and doesn't have all of the context gets to speak and is comfortable speaking to people regardless of who the other person is or what they're asking.
This is awesome. Probably got time for one more question if we go super fast.
There's one in the chat from Brian. Talk about right choice versus decision rights.
Hit it.
Oh, that's a good question. Let's talk about voice rights versus decision rights.
Verify that too. So in that artifact that I think Setterberg put out about psychological safety, mm-hmm. one thing Kessel Run struggled with early on is the distinction between being able to speak up versus being able to make the decision. And like sometimes that on both sides, the decision makers felt uncomfortable making the decision because they felt like they were stepping on people's voices. And other people thought, you know, just because I have a voice, like you should listen to me or make the decision the way that I want you to make it. So I was wondering if you could talk about the trade-offs there.
Yeah. Okay. Definitely not an expert on this by any means. I think it goes back to like, I want to make sure that I'm not taking more decision rights than I can hold on to, A. And then B, the other thing that I realized was like the key difference between accountability and responsibility is where I found the difference between like, what's my right to voice something or my right to decide on it as a PM, right? Like, yeah, I'm responsible for the team and making sure that they're equipped to do what they're doing. But I'm not accountable if someone is having a bad day or if we like make the right decisions and we're not allocated, right? Like someone else is in that mix and together we're accountable for the outcome, right? So knowing that the accountability is not entirely on my shoulders means that I can feel more often free to voice my opinion, knowing that I don't have to have the decision, right? Like I can go to leadership and say, look, here's what I'm feeling. Here's what the devs are thinking. Can you help us with the decision rights, right? Will you impart a decision here or give us your opinion? We can make a decision together. Rather than feeling like as a PM, everything begins and ends with me and I have to be accountable for every decision. And then it's much more of like, look, I need everybody to tell me everything so that I can make the right decision and then hope that I'm not wrong, right? Like that's not an effective way to lead or to facilitate a team. So maybe that took it off on a tangent, but definitely understanding the difference between accountability and responsibility for me was huge in understanding like when is it the time to say something or when is it the time that I have to make a decision.
This is awesome. I want to be respectful of people's time. We're there. This was awesome, Corey. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on too. I really appreciate this.
Thanks for taking the time to listen. We love ideas and feedback, so feel free to send your thoughts to hello@deft.org. For more great content and to stay in the loop about community events and activities, follow us on social media and subscribe to our monthly newsletter. Everyone plays a part in building the innovative national security culture we want to see. To find where you fit, just go to deft.org/join. That's deft.org/join.